Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? I have some super exciting news for you all. My book, The Carnivore Code, is officially going to be released on February 25th. By the time this podcast comes out, it should be up on Amazon. You can pre-order the ebook now. The print book will be available on February the 25th, and we will hopefully get the audiobook up at that time as well. So go to thecarnivorecodebook.com for updates. Once we are linked to Amazon, that website will direct to the Amazon page where everything will be centered. Yes, that is right. We are doing an audiobook. And yes, I am recording it this week. Perhaps as you are listening to this podcast, I am recording the audiobook. It is in my voice. So I'm super excited to share both of those things with you guys. February the 25th. Everyone who pre-ordered, thank you so much for your support. Those will be delivered to you on or before the 25th of February. So you guys get the lucky early copies. But the Carnivore Code is coming out, and I cannot be more excited to share it with you all. Stay tuned. Check my social media outlets, Instagram, Twitter, etc. I will be announcing all the stuff coming with the book, but it is going to be out in a few weeks. It is, in fact, probably going to be out in 3 weeks from the day this podcast is released. So my website is carnivoremd.com. You can see other updates there. You can also subscribe to my newsletter there, The Insider. And if you like this podcast and what I am doing here, please leave me a review on iTunes or whatever format, place, position, location you like to listen to this on. It will advance the show, and I appreciate it so much. We are now over 500 reviews. The next goal is 1,000. We want to get 1,000 reviews. I just appreciate that you guys are finding value here. And I am so blessed, grateful, lucky, appreciative to be able to do these conversations. This week is no exception. My guest is none other than Chris Kresser. I have been following Chris's work for many years and have so appreciated his measured, intelligent approach. He probably needs no introduction. But for those of you who may not know him, he is a certified functional medicine practitioner. He is the creator of the ADAPT program and health coaching training programs. He has the California Center for Functional Medicine. He is at chriskresser.com. He is a New York Times bestselling author and has a book called Unconventional Medicine. He has been nominated for the Best Inspirational Voice, Best Health and Wellness Website in 2019. He is certainly a great mind, a great force, a great asset in the functional medicine, integrative health, ancestral health space. And his podcast is Revolution Health Radio. So I am so grateful to have been able to share with him this conversation. As you will see, it is wide-ranging, but we get into a lot of topics, including the carnivore diet. And it was just fun. I never know what to title these podcasts. The last couple of that I've had my friends on, Chris Masterjohn, James DeNicolantonio, I've decided just to call them carnivore versus omnivore. It's not meant to be oppositional. It's just meant to be kind of tongue-in-cheek, just, hey, here are two guys talking, or maybe me and a woman at some point in the future, talking about our disparate views on diet. What do we think the optimal diet is? What do we think the upsides and the downsides of a carnivore diet from two different perspectives? And I love that these are all friendly, respectful debates, and I think a lot of good comes out of that. As you will hear in this podcast, we have some differing views, but we offer different sides of the issue. We also get into the game changers a little bit, and I ask Chris the hard question, which is why, during the podcast, he said he would rather be plant-based than carnivore. He actually says he didn't remember that, but I wouldn't fault him for that since he was in the midst of something pretty strange with James Wilkes on that podcast. Nevertheless, enjoy this podcast with Chris Kresser. I think you shall, and please let me know what you think of it. I was recently in Los Angeles and got to have dinner at Bel Campo in Santa Monica. As you guys will know, Bel Campo is a new sponsor of the podcast. They are a regenerative farm based in Northern California. They have 30,000 acres, which they have been farming in a regenerative fashion for a number of years. Just like White Oak Pastures, they have shown that they can increase the amount of carbon in the soil, increase the amount of organic matter in the soil in profound ways, and they are raising some of the best beef I have ever had. It is 100% grass-fed, 100% grass-finished, and I had dinner at the Santa Monica restaurant. If you guys are in Santa Monica, go to Bel Campo, get the cowboy ribeye. It is out of this world. I met one of my fans there. It was so cool. I had dinner with all kinds of other great people, but it is probably some of the best meat I've ever eaten in my whole life. They have restaurants in Los Angeles, restaurants in San Francisco, restaurants in New York. There's a Bel Campo in New York, and they have an online store, belcampo.com, and they are selling liver and thymus there. We're going to try and expand the organ meats. We're going to try and get some organ grinds. Their ribeye is amazing. It is just out of this world. I had an amazing conversation with Anya Fernwald, who is the co-director, owner of Bel Campo, and has been at the heart of this movement for so long. And what we were talking about was greenwashing and how you can look at the fatty acid composition of these animals to tell if they are being fed grass pellets or real grass finishing all to the end. And of course, Bel Campo is only going to do real grass finishing to the end, and you see a favorable ratio of omega 6 to omega 3. So a lot of what's going on out there is greenwashing. Farmers are just feeding their cows grass pellets of grass seed. It's not as nutritious. It's not even close to being the same thing. But farms like Bel Campo and White Oak are doing it the real way. And this summer, I'm going to do a meat camp at Bel Campo. You guys should come check it out. But check out belcampo.com. You can do online ordering for their premium, organic, pasture-raised, grass-fed, grass-finished meat, regenerative agriculture, contributing to carbon sequestration into the ground. And man, these cows are so good, so healthy, and the people behind it are fantastic. Please support them. You can use the code CarnivoreMD at their website for 10% off your order anytime and let them know I sent you. And check out that they have liver. People on the West Coast will really appreciate this because sometimes it's hard to get white oak on this part of the world. Speaking of white oak, these are my people. These are my friends, my family. We are going to do white oak chela. If you don't know about that, check out the whiteoakpastures.com page under events. We are doing a celebration of regenerative agriculture at White Oak, May 1st to 3rd. You guys know about White Oak. You've heard me talk about it on the podcast. They are my people. 20 years of regenerative farming on their farm in Georgia, putting organic matter and carbon back into the land. Will Harris, Jenny Harris, these are such good people. They are making amazing animals. And when you come to the farm in May, if you do, you will see the greenest grass that you have ever seen. And some of the healthiest cattle that you have ever seen, and it is delicious food. Again, they are grass-fed, grass-finished in the real way. There are no grass pellets here. There are no greenwashing here. This is the real deal, you guys, as real as it gets. Between Bel Campo and White Oak, I think these farms are producing some of the best meat on the planet, probably, certainly within the United States, and doing the right thing for regenerating the ground, the soil carbon, the soil organic matter is the future of human generations. I believe that strongly. There is no hyperbole in that statement. You can go to whiteoakpastures.com, use the code CarnivoreMD as well, 10% off your first order, or use the code Carnivore15 for 15% off the items that are featured on my page, which is info.whiteoakpastures.com/CarnivoreMD. They are sixth generation, 120 years in the family, 150 years, 120 years, something like that. And they are doing good work. I hope to see you guys at White Oak Pastures at White Oak Chela, and maybe I will see you at Bel Campo for Meat Camp this June. I also hope that I will see you in Houston, and I am hanging out with my friends at Ancestral Supplements there. These are my people, www.ancestralsupplements.com. You guys know these guys. I get messages every week from people who are saying that their symptoms improve when they are using supplements from Ancestral Supplements. These are really good quality freeze-dried organ meats and now tallow from grass-fed, grass-finished cows in New Zealand, the land of the hobbits, and they are encapsulated conveniently into a gelatin capsule. It makes it so easy if we can't obtain or we're traveling organ meats or we're not comfortable eating organ meats. These are a great go-between. They are freeze-dried. It preserves as much of the nutrients as possible. And we've actually looked at the nutrients in Ancestral Supplements and many of them are preserved in high levels. So it's the best thing other than a fresh raw liver, which is often difficult for many of us to obtain. So check it out. They are great people. AncestralSupplements.com. They have a new supplement called, which is an eye supplement. And I just saw them post on their website the MOFO, the male optimization formula, which is testicle, prostate, and liver, I believe, is coming out in the next few days. It's going to be, when this podcast is coming out, MOFO is live, and you can get freeze-dried testicle, prostate, and liver. I believe that's a formulation. And again, let them know I sent you. You can use the code SALADINOMD at their Shopify site, ancestralsupplements.com. They are putting back in what the modern world has left out. These are my people. Support my people, you guys. On to the podcast. Love you all so much. Listen afterward for what is going on with me. All right, you guys. It's an exciting time right now. It's a very exciting time right now. My book is coming out on the 25th of February. That's going to be amazing. As I said, thecarnivorecodebook.com will get you to the landing page. It used to direct to a page at my website, but hopefully by the time this podcast airs, it will direct to my Amazon page. And on that page will be an ebook, which you can pre-order. It'll be where the print book and the audio book will be sold and released on February 25th. Mark your calendars, because that will be a day to remember, and I am so excited to share my baby with you all. Hopefully you guys have seen me post about it on Instagram. I'm going to be showing the book. I've got the actual proofs in hand. I'm holding my baby in my hand as we speak. Do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear it? Here it is. Chris Kresser, my man, thanks for coming on the podcast. Good to have you here.
Paul, pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I think this will be a fun conversation. I know that we may disagree on some things, but I think that it's good to kind of offer point and counterpoint. Why don't we get started? Yeah. I think a lot of people are probably very familiar with your work and all the awesome stuff you've done, but tell us a little about your story, man. How did you get into this crazy world of functional medicine? And I'm sure that I know that you've had your own health issues.
Yeah, has something to do with that surfboard you have in the background there.
How come we've never surfed before?
I don't know. We should do it sometime.
We should.
Yeah, I did a lot of traveling in my 20s, surfing around the world. I was gone for about a year and a half on one particular trip, and I was in Indonesia on the island of Sumbawa at a place called Lakey Peak, which you might have heard of. And it was a river mouth, and the locals there were not very keen to sanitation, and they had dug a trench between this kind of stagnant pool of water that cows were milling around and defecating in into the river. And so all of that polluted water went into the river mouth and out into the surf break. So, you know, out of like 25 people that were there, 18 of us came down with a pretty intense tropical diarrheal illness, you know, all the classic symptoms that you can imagine. I was pretty out of it for 3 days, and an Australian guy who was there in the village happened to have some antibiotics in his medical kit. So I took them, recovered to some extent, you know, enough to be functional, but that kicked off like a 10-year journey back to health that involved, you know, tens of doctors and specialists around the world, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in failed treatments, and eventually found my way to an ancestral diet and, you know, a bunch of other things that we talk about in the functional medicine world now. But before the term ancestral or functional was really being used, and then decided to eventually go back to school and pursue it as a career because of my own experience.
You know, that story is all too common, unfortunately. I can think of, you know, at least 5 to 10 clients that I have right now who have similar experiences with some sort of gastroenteritis, apparently a bacterial infection causing inflammation in the gut, and then a really long and kind of bumpy course back to health. And sometimes we exhaust lots of things. I'm curious, in your case, what helped the most for you? Like, along that journey, what was the end result, or how did you kind of rehabilitate it? I mean, I can think of one client I have who's in San Francisco and feels like he drank some water a few years ago and there was a leak and there were, you know, large contamination of fecal coliform. There was large contamination of these sort of gram-negative bacteria in the water, and his gut's never been the same since. So
yeah.
What do you think were the most valuable interventions for you?
Well, it's a good question. And I would say after a decade of doing this work, a little over a decade, I've come to see things a little bit differently than I did maybe 10 years ago, and certainly 20 years ago when I was first sick. At that point, I was looking for the cause, the smoking gun, the one thing that was causing all of the problems and that I could address to recover. And I don't think it's that simple, because, you know, out of the 18 people, let's say in that village that got sick, I know because I was in contact with some of them afterwards, you know, some got violently ill and then actually recovered fairly quickly and went on with their lives. Some got ill and then, you know, had a more extended period of recovery, but maybe it was a year or two rather than 10. And then others like me got very ill and had a, you know, very long, arduous path back to health. And I think that's a function of looking back at, you know, what our ecosystem was like in that moment of exposure to those pathogens. So it's not just the pathogen itself or the pathogens in my case, but how those pathogens interact with the internal ecosystem and my own genes, gene expression, health status, you know, gut microbiome, et cetera, that determine the course of how that would go for me. So in the same vein, when I look back on what interventions were, you know, significant, it's hard to put my finger on just one, although diet was certainly a huge piece of it for me. I initially discovered the Weston Price approach to nutrition, and then just found out that even properly prepared grains and legumes were not working well for me. So I took those out and then was kind of on a de facto paleo diet before, you know, probably Rob Wolf was the only person and Lauren Cordain that were doing paleo at that time. But there was also a lot of, you know, meditation's been a big part of my path for almost 30 years now. A lot of like neuroplasticity-based kind of interventions. I took some time off where I was living at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur for a couple of years and, you know, just really focusing on my health and well-being. So I think it was a combination of all of those factors. It's hard to isolate any one of them.
Tommy Wood and I joke, half joke, I think we probably, hopefully will do this, that we want to just make a retreat center somewhere in Southern Oregon or Wyoming, kind of away from it all, that where people can just get in the dirt and chop wood and jump in cold flowing water and affect their microbiome by just being in an immersive experience and be in the sun and, you know,
have a pet dogs. Sauna.
Yeah, sauna. There. Yeah, sauna, pet dogs, you know, maybe hunt. And because it seems, I think you may be right, and we'll probably get into some of this in the podcast, there are I think a lot of this probably centers on the gut. You know, there's clearly a gut-brain connection and it's important. The neurofeedback stuff is quite fascinating to me as well. But for a lot of people, it seems to start in the gut. And the question becomes, how do we fix the gut? And perhaps fixing the gut is more than diet, more than probiotics, more than serum-derived bovine immunoglobulins, more than, you know, more than an herbal antimicrobial, more than an antibiotic. It's just freaking living in the wilderness.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say one of the biggest clinical insights I've had in the entire time that I've been practicing is that the gut is part of the nervous system. I mean, yeah. You learn this in school, of course, you know, when you study medicine or physiology and anatomy. So I'm not telling you anything you don't know or and most of the listeners, but I think there's a way in which that doesn't really fully set, you know, sink in for clinicians and patients, that the gut is the second brain or the enteric nervous system, whatever you want to call it, it's just a big bundle of nerves. And so I'm not saying that gut conditions are all in your head, because too many people have been told that, of course, when they have IBS by their doctor and there's an actual functional cause. But I am saying that there's a different doorway into healing the gut that I agree with you does not necessarily involve, or at least exclusively involve, you know, things that modulate the microbiome like probiotics or antimicrobials or, you know, other kinds of supplements that have a direct impact on the gut. But actually, if we understand that most of us are living in a chronic state of sympathetic arousal, and that in that sympathetic state, we don't get the messages from the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic nervous system that we need for proper digestive function, then that becomes a big problem, I think, in the modern world. And so, yes, you know, what the kind of intervention you're talking about, where people can get off the grid and do that, and also figuring out how to incorporate just more of that into daily life, you know, whether that's starting a meditation practice or getting a pet or getting regular massage or, you know, spending more time outside and stepping away from the computer more often, you know, restricting your use of technology. I mean, these are all things that I've cultivated in my life to try to enervate the parasympathetic system more. Like that's a major focus for me at this point.
I think that we have a real parasympathetic deficiency in our culture for sure. And I recently got back from a hunting trip, which was much needed. I'm just at the end of finishing my book project, and it's just been go, 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 as you know, lots of stress. And it was forced off the grid. It was staying in this rickety cabin way out in West Texas. It was hunting deer. It was carrying deer when we were able to obtain them, and then gutting the deer and just being in the woods, in the dirt. And I mean, I don't know that I can cite the study off the top of my head, but I've heard people talk in parlance about, you know, the effect of just being in the woods on our microbiome, and certainly being in the woods on our parasympathetic nervous system. Many listeners may be familiar with Shinrin Yoku and forest bathing, and it's hard to quantify these things, but I think that they are a real part. And so it's challenging. I mean, you're in Northern California, I'm in San Diego. I guess, do you still get out to get in the ocean? How do you, in your own life right now, I know you're doing a meditative practice, but what do you do to kind of ameliorate that parasympathetic deficiency or a nature deficiency?
Well, actually, we recently moved to Park City, Utah.
Oh,
wow. A big impetus for that move was to have greater access to the outdoors and to, you know, support my parasympathetic nervous system. So this morning I was actually doing some backcountry powder skiing.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I'm doing that quite a bit. And you know, in the summers and falls here, there's hiking and mountain biking and fishing and hunting. And, you know, it's just a much more direct connection to nature. And it was a big move for us. It took a lot to, because we've been in the Bay Area for, I mean, I originally went to UC Berkeley from 92 to 96. So I haven't been there that entire time. I did a lot of traveling, but, you know, for the better part of 25 years in and out of one place. But it became clear to me that this was a priority, and I had to find, you know, within the context of a pretty busy life, you know, practice, couple of businesses, family, et cetera, I had to live in a place where that access was easier than it was for me in the Bay Area. So we made it a priority and we made it happen. Mm-hmm. So now it's, you know, skiing, you know, downhill skiing, you know, like cross country type of skate skiing, hiking, you know, just walking out in the woods. And that's a part of my daily routine.
This is amazing. A lot of people are probably listening to this and they can't see the way that you light up when you talk about backcountry skiing. Like, this is a big Chris Gresser smile that I'm seeing. You know, those people who are watching on YouTube can see that, like, there's a real difference here in what we're talking about. And I probably get the same giddy kind of persona when I'm talking about surfing or something. But
yeah,
I guess maybe we could problem solve a little bit for people listening to this who might not have that. I've got a client in New York City, and I was just talking to her yesterday, and she said, you know, I don't really have the ability to get into the wilderness. And I thought, well, there's, you know, Central Park. And she said, they're actually replacing a lot of the grass in Central Park with turf. And I thought, oh my gosh, like, is it really, like, there's no, like, you're replacing the grass in Central Park. Like, maybe you just need to, at that point, all I can think of is just go climb a tree and sit in a tree.
Yeah.
Indoor
plants, even. I mean, there are studies that show that having indoor plants can make a big impact on your nervous system. And, you know, look, we all have to work with where we are. And I know you know this from working with your patients. And this is certainly what I've learned in my own experience struggling with chronic illness and working with my patients is, you know, there's the ideal and then there's the actual. And sometimes those are aligned and sometimes they're not. And, you know, one of my teachers, I've been a student of Zen Buddhism for many years, and she's no longer alive, but her name was Darlene Cohen. She had extremely debilitating rheumatoid arthritis to the point where when she was in a flare-up, it was so bad that she had to be people had to basically bathe her and carry her when she was living at the Zen Center. And she wrote a book called, it was originally called Turning Suffering Inside Out. And I think it has a new title now. But essentially she learned to find joy in even the simplest moments, you know, just like laying in her bed, looking out the window and seeing a bird kind of fly down and land on the branch, or watching the branch kind of swaying in the wind, or opening the window and feeling the breeze on her face. Like those seemingly mundane moments can be pretty profound if we allow ourselves to experience them. And I think when we're in difficult circumstances, whether it be like suffering from chronic pain or chronic illness, or living in New York City with no access to nature, that becomes even more important to learn how to find joy in those simple moments.
Yeah, I think it's huge. It's great. And I love that you talked about houseplants. I think everyone in New York City, that would be a great business for us to go into. We should sell houseplants in New York City, because everybody freaking needs them. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So let's pivot a little bit here. So I want to talk about this as a segue to the next segment of the podcast. There was a point in the podcast you recently did with James Wilkes. I know it's like He Who Shall Not Be Named. It's like Voldemort for me, you know, the guy won't even talk to me. You did a podcast with James Wilkes on Joe Rogan. And at one point, James makes this false dichotomy and he says, Chris, if you could eat a plant-based diet or a carnivore diet, what would you do? And you said plant-based diet, and my little carnivore heart just broke, my man. So tell me what's going on there and let's unpack this a little bit.
Yeah, so I mean, I actually don't even remember saying that, but that's a strange question.
It's clearly a fake question, right? It's kind of a silly question.
Yeah. I think you know where I stand on the issue of, you know, meat and animal products in our diet. I've made that pretty clear on multiple Joe Rogan appearances and then my work in general.
You feel like, I mean, just so the listeners know, my impression is that you feel like they're a very valuable part of human diet.
Yeah, I think they're pretty essential for most people. And, you know, whenever we're talking about these things, we're discussing generalities by necessity. And as I acknowledged on the podcast with Joe and James, I think it's certainly true objectively that we can see people who are eating a vegan diet and thriving. But does that mean that it's the best diet for everybody? Of course not. You know, there are always people at the margins that can thrive on a particular approach. But then if you try to extrapolate that to the general population, you get into a lot of trouble. So I think my position has been and still is that for the majority of people, a diet that includes both animals and plants is the best bet. And then, you know, we can talk about that, and we can also talk about the margins.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want.
Yeah, let's start with the vegan margin. Personally, I'm skeptical of, and perhaps this could be turned back on me with regard to carnivore diets. Personally, I'm quite skeptical that humans can thrive on plant-based diets long term. When I did a podcast with Chris Masterjohn, and you've said this as well, Chris brought up this really great point that we really need to be careful when we're saying plant-based. Does that mean you're getting 2% of your foods from animals? Because as you and both Chris Masterjohn have pointed out, if you get 2% of your foods from animals, and that's oysters and liver, that's a very unique subset of nutrients. Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to be proven wrong here, as I am in general, but I doubt that humans can thrive on an exclusively vegan diet long-term without excessive synthetic supplementation. I think that most of the athletes we see using vegan diets to any significant extent are using massive amounts of highly processed pea protein or hemp protein and are probably, as we know, taking B12 supplements, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not convinced that humans are really meant to thrive on a plant-based diet ever at all. And that we're looking at snapshots of people who can subsist for some short amount of time with massive amounts of supplementation. I think that when we're looking at any diet, and perhaps this is just a philosophical construct, but I think if we're looking at any diet and thinking about how this diet is going to serve us as humans, we need to remove supplements. And again, maybe that's too strict, but I think we should be able to remove supplements and say, can you get everything you need with all plants without supplements? And I don't think you can. I don't think humans can thrive doing that. I don't have a lot of experience with plant-based diets, although I was a raw vegan for 7 months and yeah. I was 25 to 30 pounds lighter. It was just impossible. And so I think that the claims that people can thrive on plant-based diets, I question this, and I don't think there's a lot of veracity here. People will point to others like Rich Roll, and I did a podcast with him on the minimalists. And, you know, I don't believe that these guys are not doing heavy supplementation. And there's this.
What did you say about that? I'm curious, because I've met him a few times, and I generally like him and think he's a good guy. So I'm just curious, like, did you ask him if he's supplementing? I'm curious what he said.
He downplayed it. So he was asked on that podcast, what do you eat? And he basically described a fruit smoothie in the morning, a cup of coffee, a vegan burrito, and then some sort of vegan dinner. And I was thinking, that's like probably 30 grams of plant-based protein in a day, maybe 40. Mm. And though James on the Rogan podcast wanted to debate the actual precision of the DIAS score, he was wrong about many of his claims. Yeah. Yeah. And I've gone back and sort of tried to point that out to people that he was claiming DIAS wasn't effective, and he was incorrect. And many of the references he cited were just blind references that didn't show anything. But anyway, if we look at the DIAS and we look at the amount of protein bioavailability, I mean, Rich was suggesting a diet that probably had 40 grams or less of protein. I'm thinking, there is no way. I mean, Rich is a pretty skinny guy. He doesn't have a whole lot of muscle mass, but I'm thinking, man.
But he's an endurance athlete too. I mean, so he's going to need a significant amount of protein to do that.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I was unconvinced, and then he kind of downplayed it and said, I take B12 occasionally. And I'm thinking, like, what? Anyway, so it just gets to the point where it's like, is this really what you're doing? Mm-hmm. Until we have hidden cameras, we don't know. And I don't know, but there are not, I think that when I talk to people in these circles, and I did a podcast with a couple of really great, nice guys who are vegan and in the type 1 diabetes world, and they said that, I mean, I asked them and they were using hemp protein and zinc supplements and B12, and I thought, okay, that's something, you know, you're still supplementing a lot and you're probably still not getting enough protein. So I'm just curious. So what are your thoughts on that?
I basically agree. Yeah. I never rule out the possibility of outliers.
Sure.
So I hesitate to make absolute statements, but I've never been an advocate of a 100% vegan diet for all the reasons that you mentioned. And I would add to that we don't have any ancestral examples of populations that thrived over a long period of time on a vegan diet. So, no, that's not the end all be all, but if I look at things, I try to use kind of a triangulation of evidence or perspectives when I'm thinking about a question like this. One would be anthropological, archaeological, ancestral perspective. I think that is valid and helpful. It doesn't answer all of the questions, but it generates some ideas and hypotheses, and it also gives us some case studies essentially that we can look at and say, okay, well, this is what's worked for most ancestral populations for the longest period of time. And we don't see evidence of a group that was on a completely vegan diet for a long period of time. Therefore, it introduces some doubt and question mark about the sustainability of that approach. Then we look at modern evidence, you know, the published peer-reviewed literature that we have now, which can include both, you know, observational evidence with all the caveats that we both know that comes with, and then randomized controlled trials. And then the third leg, which is perhaps the least convincing in some ways, but also the most convincing in others, is just clinical experience, you know, seeing what happens with real people in the clinic, as I know you've done with the carnivore diet. So I don't like to rely on any one of those in isolation, but when you put them together, I think you can get the best picture. And if we do that for a vegan diet, it doesn't come out very well.
And one of the arguments, and then we can move on from this, that plant-based advocates will sometimes use is we need to look at the weight of the evidence. And I think that's just so absurd. James tried to do this in the Rogan podcast too. Like, we need to consider the consensus or the weight of the evidence. And I think if you're just having a weight of horse poop, it's all horse poop. If we're looking at all bad epidemiology observational study, then that's just so silly. And as we know, there are plenty of observational epidemiology studies to that conflict with the idea that plant-based diets are the most valuable for humans. I mean, there are observational studies in Asia that I've spoken about before in which the people that eat the most meat, the men that eat the most meat have the lowest rates of cardiovascular disease, and the women that eat the most meat have the lowest rates of cancer. So how does anyone reconcile that? I think we have to just kind of say, look, epidemiology is very misleading. Let's look at the interventional stuff and kind of go from there.
Yeah. And one of my favorite quotes from Anatole France, even if 50 million people say a foolish thing, it's still a foolish thing. All you have to do with that comment is just rewind 50 years and say, what was the weight of evidence 50 years ago? Well, now we look back at that and we say that they were clearly wrong. But if you take the weight of evidence at any time point in the past, it was, you know, not very impressive now for us looking back. So why are we so arrogant to assume that that's not also going to be the case, you know, 10 or 20 years from now?
I couldn't agree more. And I think there's another quote. I don't know exactly who said this, but it's something like, if you repeat a lie often enough, it becomes the truth.
Yeah.
Was that Hitler? I don't know.
Maybe Goebbels. Goethe? Pronounce his name. No, Goethe. Goebbels. He's the propaganda minister. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
What's the name of that? It's a rhetorical fallacy, but it, you know, it's very well employed by politicians, particularly some very prominent ones right now where, yeah, if you, it's, you say something enough times, it starts to seem true. So, you know, we could go, there's a whole another rabbit hole there to go down, but
maybe we'll have time. We'll see. Yeah. Maybe we'll have time. We'll see. Yeah. That's what I think. I'll just add for the listener that, what I'm thinking of now is all of the plant-based rhetoric around the environment and around, it just gets repeated over and over, and the Golden Globes, and everyone has just accepted this as fact. And you think, wait a minute. And similarly, and these are the type of untruths that I hope to counter or offer counter perspectives on in my book. Similarly, just untruths regarding meat and cancer, meat and heart disease, these other things, they just get repeated so often. I went on the doctors recently, and you know, their promo for this episode, in the episode, we had a case study of two women that I had worked with who were able to reverse lupus with ANAs that went negative in terms of the titer, and their symptoms completely resolved on a carnivore diet. And in the promo for the doctors, they say, is this going to help you or is it going to give you cancer? And it's just, you know, in that episode, they
sensational.
Had... Sensational. Yeah, it's sensational. They had Joel Kahn, and at the end, he just says, what if these women get cancer in 15 or 30 years? Is Dr. Saladino, you know, able to be sued? And you think, that's just so misleading. It's so unfortunate that people are using this WHO report, and that's a whole nother rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the other side. And I will just admit from the beginning of this conversation that there are also no anthropologic reports of people doing an entirely carnivorous diet, as you point out. So there's no anthropologic reports of people doing an entirely plant-based diet. And there's a famous comparison that Weston Price made between the Kikuyu and another tribe in Africa, noting the Kikuyu ate less animal products and the other tribe ate more animal products, and the more animal product containing tribe was more robust. So, but there's also no anthropologic examples that we're aware of people eating fully carnivorous diets long-term. But let's go to the other side and talk about sort of your perspective on an entirely animal-based diet. What do you think? What do you think about something like that? What do you see as potential pitfalls?
So if we use those three, you know, that triangle again, you just talked about the anthropological evidence, and I agree there's no clear examples there that we can refer to. So that, you know, lack of evidence isn't evidence against. It doesn't mean, that doesn't on its own mean that 100% carnivorous diet is dangerous. It just means that we don't know. It's a question mark there. And then if we go to, let's go to clinical first. I mean, that's where this is most impressive to me and interesting is like you. I mean, I certainly don't have probably anywhere near the number of patients doing carnivore diet that you do, but I have a few and I have seen some pretty significant improvements and shifts. And, you know, some people ended up on it kind of just by process of elimination, literally, you know, just taking out more and more foods until they found the one that the group of foods that was safe for them to eat that didn't cause symptoms, which happened to be meat and fish and maybe a few other things. But and other people embarked on it more intentionally, like after reading about it, maybe listening to your podcast or something like that. And so I would say that the conditions that I've seen it have the biggest impact on would be autoimmune conditions, as you talk about a lot, and also probably gut conditions and any kind of immune related condition, not just necessarily autoimmunity, but allergies, asthma, skin stuff that isn't necessarily autoimmune, but you know, the immune system obviously controls a lot or influences a lot in the body. So something that can have a positive impact on the immune system can have a pretty broad general effect. You know, it hasn't been a panacea. Some people didn't respond to it well. We can talk about that later or soon. The third leg there, which is the clinical evidence, the observational evidence, that's where I have some questions. I listened to both of, you know, your interview with Chris and Chris's interview with you, where you guys did a very deep dive into the minutiae of questions about potential nutrient deficiencies, you know, vitamin C and folate and manganese and molybdenum and some other nutrients that might, if it's not well constructed, to use the term du jour, that somebody might get into trouble, especially because we know that, and this comes up with vegan diets too, certain people either have a higher demand for some nutrients because of whatever's going on in their internal ecosystem, or they may have genetically or epigenetically a higher demand for nutrients because of issues in their conversion pathways, you know, from precursor to active forms of nutrients. Now, that's a lesser problem with carnivore diet, because carnivore diet tends to have the fully active forms of the nutrients rather than the precursors. But, you know, there's still some questions about vitamin C, folate, some of the nutrients. I have some questions about fermentable fiber. We can talk about that. So the way I would characterize it is just, I don't know. You know, like there's enough evidence that gives me some cause for concern, but I'm neither certain that it's harmful to follow a carnivore diet forever, nor am I certain that it's harmless. So that's kind of how I would characterize my position at this point.
That's great. Thank you. I think that anthropologically, as I maybe pointed out with Chris, there are some cultures that have gotten pretty close. Inuit, Sami, you know, some people characterize these as 90 to 99% carnivore. Chris brought up a great point in that podcast that generally closer to the equator, people eat more plants. So then, you know, I'm going to do a podcast with Lauren Cordain in the near future. I think it's also important to think about the availability of megafauna. And when there's not megafauna available, we probably do need some plants in our diet because we don't have enough fat. So this is quite an interesting equation. This is kind of what I like about the carnivore diet. It just brings up, it challenges so many long-held notions that are thought to be canon. And we think, is that really true? But what I've kind of come to realize is that there's plenty of protein in nature if we can hunt animals. You can hunt squirrels, you can hunt rabbits, you can hunt deer, you can hunt, you know, antelope, whatever you can hunt. But there's not a whole lot of megafauna left. Interestingly, the cultures, the Norwegian cultures probably had access to the last remaining megafauna in the form of whales and seals. And those seals are not large. They have a lot of fat. And what we know is that if you're going to do a low-carb diet, you have to get a lot of fat. Well, fat is not super available near the equator for a lot of people outside of big, big animals. And so I wonder, you know, throughout human evolution, if we were hunting perhaps in equatorial regions and there were more megafauna, we had more access to fat, it would have made it more tenable. But right now, and certainly in the last probably 40,000 years, we can trace the extinction of the megafauna as humans move across continents. I think that it's totally reasonable to imagine that humans are eating some plants because they just can't get enough fat. And when I was able to get a deer in Texas, there was not a lot of fat on that animal. There was a little bit around the kidneys and a little bit behind the eyes.
which is, you know, limited. And then you're like, and maybe a little bit in the marrow, but you're thinking, wow, I'm not going to get enough fat. And Joe Rogan did a podcast with Glenn Villeneuve, which was really interesting to me. He's the guy who was on Life Below Zero in Alaska. And he said the same thing, that he was always after fat. And he was hunting a little bit bigger animals, but you know, you get a moose, that's going to give you enough fat. But to me, it seems like in nature, the critical nutrients are carbohydrates and fat. So we know that we need one or the other, or we're going to get into big problems. We're going to get rapid starvation and overconsumption of protein.
I think that's possible. I appreciated your discussion with Chris about this. He had some other ways of, you know, perspectives and counterpoints. The reality is, as you both acknowledge, that we just don't know at this. I mean, it's very interesting to me to speculate. But at the end of the day, we don't know whether, you know, our consumption increasing, you know, our consumption of more vegetables and fruits at the equator was essentially an adaptation to a change in the environment that was due to human activity, you know, basically over hunting the mega fauna.
Yeah.
Or it was for some other reason. But what's interesting to me is that we adapted. And that's, you know, when I look at a lot of the studies of ancestral populations, that's something that stands out to me, is that, you know, you have the Inuit who are at some times of the year, at least probably up at that 95% animal product ratio. At other times of year, probably lower. And there's some evidence that they were pretty active in trading for some, you know, some plant foods. And then you look at like the Kitava and the Tucacenta and other more equatorial populations that had a much higher intake of plant foods, and they both seem to do pretty well. I mean, again, that's also difficult to quantify, because even at the times that we were studying these populations, their arguably environment had changed pretty significantly beyond what it was even 100 years before that. So, but, you know, they're not, as far as we could tell, they weren't developing diabetes and heart disease and hypertension and, you know, most forms of cancer, and they weren't obese, and, you know, they had good body mass index and oxygen deliverability, like all the parameters that we understand that define health, these people had, you know. Yeah. And if they had some emergency medical care, their lifespans would probably be similar to our own, but they don't reach those ages with all those chronic diseases that we get.
Yeah. Well, I did a podcast with James Clement recently, and he pointed something out to me, that if people in indigenous populations, and this is a broad sweeping statement, if people in indigenous populations make it to the age of 50, they have the same life expectancy as us, with squaring of the morbidity curve, meaning they don't get chronic disease. And, you know, one of the things that I agree with you on is that I don't think carbohydrates are bad for humans. I think we need to think about how we're eating them. And I think that there are these examples of people who have eaten plant foods and are thriving. What's interesting to me is kind of the thinking, like, what's optimal? You know, if they could have gotten more animal foods, would that have been better? And like you said, we're just all trying to figure this out. And as you point out, the Catawbans and the Tavaruans, kind of a low-fat society, right? They're fishing. They don't have a lot of access to fat. And in that situation, carbohydrates become very valuable, and you kind of need to swap out those two nutrients. So I'm curious.
Although, to your point, this interesting thing in those populations, the chiefs and the people of higher status ate a lot more pork, whereas the sort of common people were eating almost exclusively fish. So there, you could argue that there's some evidence there that, you know, the pork was the higher value source of calories there, or source of nutrients.
Yeah. And I'm trying to find this quote. I think it's in Nutrition and Physical Generation. It's kind of an observation that Weston Price made, that generally with indigenous peoples, the more animal foods that are available, the more they eat. And that it's just their consumption of animal foods is only limited by their availability. So it kind of brings up this interesting question, which we'll probably be discussing for many years to come. You know, if you can get all animal foods in your diet, number one, is that healthy? Should you? You know, and is that a way that can bring significant health for people?
I think there's some other questions that are interesting there that you may or may not want to talk about. But another question is, do you want to, and do you like eating only animal foods? And because, you know, going back to what I said earlier in the show, I've just after doing this work for a long time, I've come to see that there are often multiple paths to healing for a given person. And I think I got stuck initially on my own road back to health, thinking that there was just one way, and that can be really stressful and aggravating trying to find that one way back to health. And after working with people for many years and just through my own experience, I've come to see that there actually is often more than one way. So you take two people with autoimmune disease, let's say. So one heals themselves gets to be symptom free. We can talk about whether it's really a cure. I'm not particularly interested in that, but they get symptom free, their antibodies go down, they feel great on a carnivore diet, right? Then you take another person who maybe they could have done that and they would have got the same result, but they choose to do something else. Maybe they really focus on cultivating more joy and connection with the outdoors. They go to your new retreat center that you're going to build and
jump in rivers.
They change their life in some significant ways. They're focusing more on neuroplasticity based kind of interventions because that's what they're drawn to. And for them, following a super strict, restrictive diet may actually generate more stress that could further trigger the autoimmune condition. And, you know, who's to say that one way is better than the other way in that situation? They both end up in a place that they want to end up, but it's just a different approach for different people. So that's interesting to me too.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And from that perspective, as I've thought more about the carnivore diet and written the book, what I've kind of come to see as the 50,000 foot view is that what I'm hoping to communicate to people is the value of animal foods. I call it an exoneration of animal foods, right? And give some context to a spectrum of plant toxicity. And I think that when we're thinking about those two things, accepting that animal foods are the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet, and that plants can have toxicity, and that we might be able to construct a spectrum of toxicity for different people, and, you know, eliminating the most toxic plants, I think we're moving in the direction of carnivore. I call that carnivore-ish, but I think that I totally agree with you. I think there are a lot of people who want to include plant foods for variety, color, texture, entertainment, and that's totally reasonable with the understanding that if we include those plant foods with some attention to a spectrum of plant toxicity, we may serve that person better and realize that plants, I mean, I don't know if you would agree or disagree with this, but plants and animals have been co-evolving for 400 million years, and there really are plant toxins out there, and people do sometimes react to plants negatively, and I think we have to be careful and think about plants on a spectrum in that way.
I would agree with that. I would add that I think plant toxins are a bigger problem for people who are struggling with certain issues like autoimmunity or immune dysregulation of some type or GI issues. When I look at someone who's very healthy, strong, you know, good gut microbiome, they're eating a good diet, they're doing all the right things, I'm not fully convinced that plant toxins are an issue for that person. Like I read Dr. Gundry's book. I didn't agree with a lot of the claims made there, and I looked up a lot of the references, and they didn't actually support what was being said in the text. And so, you know, I've used this analogy in the past. Like, if you break your arm, and you know, it's a good idea to wear a cast, and a cast is the appropriate thing to do in that situation. But once your arm is, there's no reason to put a cast on a healthy arm. So, I'm not at all persuaded that everybody needs to be on a carnivore diet. I don't think there's really much evidence at all to support that. I am persuaded that for a subset of the population who's dealing with these kinds of issues, that it can be a powerful intervention, and that plant toxins for that subset are probably a bigger problem than they are for other people. And, you know, another example of that would be like FODMAPs. So for someone who has IBS, SIBO, any a spectrum of GI issues, eating garlic and onions can just be a like excruciating experience. Three hours of pain doubled up on the floor. I've had patients go to the hospital thinking they were having their appendix was rupturing or something like that when it was just gas pain from eating garlic and onions. And yet, on, you know, someone who doesn't have that issue can just chow down, you know, garlic and onions and have no problem at all. So again, you know, we may disagree on this, but that's kind of where I'm coming from with the plant toxin issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And Chris and I talked a lot about many of the nutrient deficiencies. I don't think we need to dwell on that here. There's pretty good evidence you can get ample amounts of folate and biotin and riboflavin if you're eating nose to tail. And that the vitamin C issue, I think, is something we don't fully understand. As I've stated before in podcasts with James DeNicolantonio, I'm far from convinced that mega doses of vitamin C are beneficial. We know that doses as low as 10 milligrams will cure scurvy. And if we look at interventional studies, it's not incredibly convincing that doses beyond 50 to 70 milligrams really change much in the way of oxidative stress markers. So, and those are doses of vitamin C that I think are obtainable from fresh animal foods. I will emphasize your point that it's important to construct any diet intentionally. And if people are overcooking their meat, that could deplete the amount of vitamin C in it. If they're not eating liver, if they're not eating organs, we may not get enough. But it certainly looks to me, both personally and in what I'm seeing in my practice, that people eating a carnivore diet that's nose to tail with meats that aren't overcooked, including organ meats, are not having issues in terms of oxidative stress markers, as far as I can tell. And I talked about this with Chris a little bit, checking mine and other people's, you know, lipid peroxides, 8-hydroxy-2-deoxyguanosine. And there are a couple of studies that show that if you, you know, interventionally, if you increase, you know, fruits and vegetables and you go from 70 to 270 milligrams of vitamin C in a day, there's no real change despite an increase in vitamin C in the blood. So the nutrients, I don't see any real evidence for nutrient deficiencies, but if I'll let you respond to that if you want, and then let's talk about fiber.
I think that's all possible, and you may be right. With vitamin C, I know Chris brought this up too. You know, there's avoiding acute issues like scurvy, and then there's what's the long-term chronic disease risk, which can be, I think, a lot harder to piece out because most of those conditions take decades to develop. And I would say we don't yet even have a complete understanding of how they do develop. And so again, it's like, I don't feel strongly or dogmatic about this. It's just, there's a question mark in my mind about that. And I think we could get 40 or 50 years from now and you're thriving, you and the carnivore crew are thriving, and you know all the people who are eating plants have dropped dead by then, and that I think that's a totally possible outcome, and I hope that's the outcome. Not that people eating plants dropping dead, but that you're thriving and everybody else who's been doing that is thriving. But I'm just a little hesitant and cautious, I think, because of the lack of a population we can look at that has done this over a long period of time and didn't have any issues. And because of some of just the uncertainty with nutrients like vitamin C, where yes, you're getting the amount to avoid, you know, acute issues like scurvy, but is it enough for the long term? So, yeah, you know, I don't really want to go into like the minutia with every nutrient, because I think you did that really well with Chris. And we only have a short time left, but that's just my hesitation.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that I asked Chris in that podcast, or I hope I asked Chris, was what markers would you check? And let's check them and let's see. And some of those markers are hard to do, like oxidized to reduce glutathione, but yep, I've done my best to check all the other markers that I can think of that would give me some clinical indication of inadequate vitamin C status. Well, let's talk about fiber, because you mentioned that one as a concern, or at least a point. What are you thinking there? Because when I've dug into this, you know, there's evidence that fiber is helpful in some situations, but a lot of those studies are comparing it to standard American diets, you know? And so it's always the question, what is fiber compared to? And as you know, there are studies showing that the removal of fiber can improve idiopathic constipation. And I've talked about this many times in the past, diverticulosis, cancer. There's really not a whole lot of evidence here that fiber is beneficial. So people talk about the microbiome, but you know, perhaps I jumped the gun there.
Well, maybe, yeah. So maybe we should actually even step further back and just say fiber and talk about the microbiome and the relationship between like a ketogenic diet. I mean, there are no studies that I'm aware of a carnivore diet's effect on the microbiome.
Oh yeah, there are.
Are there?
Absolutely, yeah. So the study is called, it is called Diet
Re- Where did they find these people?
They did it at Harvard. So diet rapidly and reproducibly alters the gut microbiome. It was done in 2014 and published in Nature. So pretty fascinating. And it was only, it was a week long, but they could see changes in the microbiome over the course of that week. So they had a plant-based diet in one group and a carnivore diet in the other group. And it wasn't even a well-constructed carnivore diet. I don't know what the methionine glycine ratio was. I don't actually know how much collagen they were getting. As I've talked about in the past, it looks like animal collagen, and we know certainly animal protein can be fermented into short-chain fatty acids that are that can serve as fuel for the colonic epithelial cells. So yeah, they had the limitations of the study are that it were only a week, but they show no decline in alpha diversity in the carnivore group. They had an increase in beta diversity, and they show an increase in bile acid tolerant organisms, which you would expect on a diet that increases bile. Yeah. And so they make the statement in the book that in the study that it seems plausible that the human microbiome can shift based on patterns when humans are having to rely on what they call fallback foods. And I appreciated that because I think of plants as fallback foods too. But yeah, that's a pretty interesting study. We certainly need longer studies, but I think that's amazing that there actually is a study on the carnivore diet and microbiome.
So great. I'd love to see that. Maybe you could send it to me.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that one. I have seen some other studies, which I can send to you. You've probably seen most of them on ketogenic diets and very low carb diets having effects on the microbiome that were interpreted by the researchers as being undesirable. And I use that word intentionally because if it is possible that there is an adaptation or a shift in the microbiome where, example of this would be the Hadza have low levels of bifidobacteria, which, you know, is in the West a sign associated or correlated with good gut health. So is that what's happening when someone goes on a ketogenic or a carnivorous diet, perhaps? But again, it's just a question mark for me and a hesitation given what we don't know. And I think the other concern that I have is just clinically, in some patients who've been on, a long-term ketogenic diet. And I have fewer patients that have been doing a carnivore diet, especially for any significant length of time at this point that I can reference, but, when they wanted, for various reasons, to add plant foods or carbohydrates back into their diet at some point, were not able to. They had pretty significant reactions, GI, skin breakouts, and they tried multiple times to reintroduce to smaller amounts. My hypothesis is that they lost the bacteria that helped break down and metabolize those compounds in those plant foods because they were no longer necessary in their diet. And, is it the end of the world that they have to stay on that diet, continuously, or is there some other way maybe to reintroduce those bacteria? No, and possibly respectively, but, I've seen that a few times and I don't know what to make of it, but it was notable.
And the alternative hypothesis there is that those foods might actually be triggering those symptoms in those people, right? That this is an elimination type diet and that it might not have anything to do with the microbiome. I recently did a podcast with Lucy Mayling and we were talking about this idea that at least in animal models, if you remove fiber, and I don't know exactly what the animals were fed, but if you remove plant fiber for four generations, they can lose certain organisms and then not recover them. I don't know if we know if that's happening in humans, but I think that the alternative hypothesis is that these plant foods could certainly be triggering their issues and you're just seeing that you're reintroducing and they're getting the reaction, right? Wouldn't that be plausible?
That is a possible alternative hypothesis.
Yeah. And the other thing I would think about, well, maybe you can clarify this for me as we start to wrap up. In the studies that you mentioned with ketogenic diets in which investigators were interpreting the changes as unfavorable, what were the changes? Because you kind of hinted at this. Perhaps you're familiar with studies that show this, but I am not. I'm not familiar with any studies that show significant declines in alpha diversity. Of course, when we're talking about the microbiome, it's very hard to quantify it. Like, how do we put our hands around the microbiome? A lot of times people will point to changes in specific species of bacteria. And personally, and I've, you know, other people in the field, I've talked and asked to them about this. I don't think we know that one bacteria changing means that the microbiome is shifting unfavorably. We might be able to say broadly that something like overgrowth of proteobacteria would be a bad thing, but I've not seen that in the literature with the removal of fiber. Certainly not seen that clinically. But when the researchers are saying these are unfavorable changes in the microbiome, do you know what they're referring to? I don't mean to put you on the spot. I'm just curious if you know. Is it loss of lactobacillus or bifido or...
Both from some of the studies that I've seen, and I've had discussions with Justin Sonnenberg. Have you had him on your show?
No, I'd love
to. Do you know he would be a good guest? Maybe you can do an intro because I think he would be able to speak to this a lot more cogently than I am able to right now, especially because I didn't review those studies before this interview. But I think referring to shifts in genera and looking at, you know, bifidobacteria, lactobacillus. My impression is that it's more of a decline in beneficial genera than an increase in pathogenic species. It would be interesting for you to talk to him about it because he wrote a book about microbiota accessible carbohydrates or MACs, as you've probably seen. And I think he would be a great guest to explore this issue in further depth with.
Have you seen the study on cheetahs? I talked about this with Lucy, the fermentation of animal components in strict carnivores, a comparative study with cheetah fecal inoculum. They talk about, admittedly it's in cheetahs, but they talk about, I guess it would be really interesting to have this conversation with Justin and say, what's the concern? You know, and what are microbiota accessible carbohydrates? Could we say, because we know that bacteria in the gut can turn protein into short chain fatty acids, right? And presumably that's what people are referring to, that when we're talking about microbiota associated carbohydrates, we're saying, hey, this carbohydrate can be turned into a short chain fatty acid by the bacteria. So it's not so much the bacteria need the carbohydrate, that the colonic epithelial cells need short chain fatty acids, butyrate being the one people always talk about, and with signaling roles. But as has been pointed out, you know, there's isobutyrate, propionate, acetate, they can signal in the gut in the same way and similarly serve as fuel for the colonic epithelial cells. So the question for Justin might become in the future, stay tuned listeners for this one, why can't we use protein or collagen? You know, the cheetah microbiome can do it. They can make short chain fatty acids. And these might be animal fiber. I talk about this in the book. Is this just animal fiber versus plant fiber? We probably need something for our gut bugs to ferment. But like we know, is the Inuit microbiome unhealthy? They're not getting a whole lot of microbiota accessible carbohydrates. And many cultures, you know, probably didn't for the majority of the year.
Yeah, I mean, it would be also interesting to ask him if he thinks there are benefits or effects beyond the production of short chain fatty acids that come from the fermentation of fiber, specifically, rather, because that's another question mark. Is there anything that's relevant, you know, with fiber consumption above and beyond the short chain fatty acid production, which seems to be the, you know, at least one of the primary mechanisms for the proposed benefit.
Yeah. And as you're saying, I think it's very interesting. And I caution people against saying this species of bacteria is good. You know, I just don't think that from my perspective, we don't know enough about, as we talked about, the ecosystem of the microbiome and how many nodes there are to say, oh, lactobacillus declined, bifido decline, is that a bad thing? As you point out, there are indigenous cultures who have been studied who don't even possess those, you know, bacteria. And I think that those conclusions are premature. From my perspective, we don't really know how to construct a healthy microbiome. And many now have said this is almost becoming a truism. The microbiome you have when you're healthy is a healthy microbiome. I think there's some Trump truth to that, but I'm curious.
I think so as well. I mean, Jeff Leach and others have said that for many years, like we don't know what a healthy microbiome looks like in an individual. what we can say is we can basically draw inferences. And again, from observational data where we say in this particular population, this pattern of bacteria seems to be associated with better health than this other pattern of bacteria. And, you know, and then sometimes comparing populations like modern Italians with Burkina Faso, you know, and observing bowel patterns in the Burkina Faso population versus the modern Italian. But that doesn't even necessarily mean that if you were able to transplant the microbiome of someone from Burkina Faso into a modern Italian, that that would go well. It might not go well. And I've actually seen this in, you know, some of, I've had several patients do fecal microbiota transplants, either, you know, through the Tamount Clinic in the UK or a couple of other places that I'm aware of that I'm not at liberty to speak of publicly. One place, very interestingly, was using the microbiota from a somewhat indigenous population. And I saw instances where that didn't go well, and it, you know, it didn't seem to be because a pathogen was passed. It was just like a mismatch between the host ecosystem and the microbiome from that completely different population.
I've heard of anecdotes like this Amazonian microbiota being transplanted into kids with autism and having them get worse.
Yeah.
So it's complicated, and I don't think we know. And so I think generally, what's been encouraging for me is that on zero fiber diets, like a carnivore diet, a lot of people get pretty significant improvement in GI symptoms. And I think that's great. And then we can check, you know, I've checked my alpha diversity. A lot of people in the carnivore community, these are anecdotes, admittedly, have checked alpha diversity and see pretty robust alpha diversity. As you know, I'll just mention this and then we'll wrap up, that fasting can affect alpha diversity positively. Yep. So lack of fiber and fasting can affect acromantium eosinophilia positively. So it's not that lack of fiber is known to be damaging to the gut. And these are probably all great questions for the upcoming podcast with Justin, hopefully.
Well, so, I think, I mean, another way of talking about that is when I mentioned before, I think there are multiple paths to healing. There's probably multiple paths to a healthy microbiome. You know, so it's possible that eating lots of microbiota accessible carbohydrates in the context of, you know, nutrient dense diet works well for some people.
Yeah.
I mean, I think objectively that we could say that from some of the research, but that doesn't mean that there isn't another possible way of obtaining a healthy microbiome. And that for some people, that way actually might be the only way because of whatever that we don't fully understand. Like they're not able to tolerate those plant foods, or those plant foods have a toxic effect that causes inflammation. And inflammation itself becomes then something that harms the microbiome or makes it difficult for healthy bacterial populations to take root. So for that person, removing those might actually be the pathway. So like I said, I'm open to all of these possibilities. I'm just very curious to see how it will all play out.
Lots to learn, man. Lots to learn. Thanks so much for coming on. Where can people find more of your stuff, Chris?
ChrisCresser.com is my main website. And then for, I have a training program for clinicians that want to practice functional medicine, and also a health coach training program. And those are at CresserInstitute.com.
Cool. And those are, from what I've seen, those are excellent. I hopefully will get a little more information about that all soon. And this is the last question I always ask people, and I never warn them. So I'm just, it's like out of the blue. This is the left hook. What is the most radical thing? I think you're going to have lots of answers to this one. Sometimes my guests don't have it. What is the most radical thing you have done recently? It might've even happened this morning.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that along those lines, like I've basically taken a month off, almost not completely from work, but just really have been doing a lot of skiing, spending a lot of time outside, really cut back on my work commitments significantly, and just spending a lot of time in solitude and nature. And that might not seem radical for some people, but
that's pretty radical
when you're running two businesses and a clinic and, you know, have 50 employees, it felt radical to me. So, Yeah. And it's had a radical impact on me for sure. It's been a tremendously powerful and healing experience. And I'm going to maybe have a hard time shifting back into gear after this.
That's awesome. It's good to see you smiling on this interview. That's great. That's great. So, all right, man, thank you so much. I would love to do a part two soon and people can look forward to the interview with Justin Sonnenberg.
Great. Thanks, Paul, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That is me flipping the pages in my book. That didn't really have the dramatic effect I was hoping for, but you get the idea. The book is in hand. The pre-orders are coming. It's February 25th. Mark your calendars. Tell everyone the Carnivore Code is going to rock the world. It's going to rock the world. Check out my website, carnivoremd.com. Sign up for my newsletter called The Insider. I share articles, all kinds of good stuff there. And please leave me a review for this podcast on iTunes, wherever you like to listen to it, because it helps more people find it. And I love doing this. This is probably my first baby. The podcast is my first baby. The book is my second baby. I got babies. That's how it goes. I love doing this. And the audiobook, super fun. I know you guys are stoked. I'm recording it every day. Watch my Instagram stories if you want to see me recording the book. It's not that exciting to watch. It'll be better to listen to. All right, you guys. So that is what is going on with me. I've got a lot of travel coming up. I'm going to be in New York City at the end of this month doing a media tour. Going to be on some TV shows. I'll share about that soon. Hopefully some podcasts that are quite exciting and intriguing. Got some exciting news there to share with you guys soon. And then in March, I've got a couple other events. What am I doing in March? I'm probably going to be at the Arnold in March. So if you guys are going to be at the Arnold, look for me there. In April, I'm going to be back in New York City for Biohack the World. I'm going to be doing kind of a post-launch launch to celebrate the book in April in New York City. And in June is KetoCon. Lots of cool things happening, you guys. Lots of cool things happening with me. Keep posted. Stay up to date. Sign up for The Insider. Support my stuff. Support my people. Belcampo. I love these guys. Check them out. You will not be disappointed. This is the best meat you've ever had. White Oak Pastures leading the charge in regenerative agriculture. Whit Harris is one of the best humans on the planet. I love Jenny Harris too. And they make, probably with Belcampo, the best meat on the planet. Like that's the good stuff, you guys. That's the good stuff. Carnivore MD at both of those places will get you a discount. Ancestral supplements. And after that, there is nothing else to say. On to the podcast. Well, we already said that. We're done with the podcast. Hope you guys like that one. Leave me a review. I will see you in the next podcast. Oh, did you see that I got t-shirts? They say Stay Radical and they're amazing. They're on my website under merchandise, under the media tab. Tag me in a photo of you in the t-shirt and I will repost it. Join the Carnivore Army. We should call it something else. I don't know what we're going to call it. The Carnivore Army, the Nose to Tail Army, Nose to Tail Army, the Stay Radical Army. Join the Stay Radical Army, you guys. Did you see that doctor's episode? The Stay Radical Army is coming for the doctors. That's all I've got to say. All right, you guys. Love you all. See you in the next episode. Take care.